this is really where we're going to talk a bit as colleagues about how these difficult stories get written, get produced, get published. Let me just introduce you in a slightly different way to both of these winners, which some of you have had a chance to look at. There are copies on the back table. But starting with the St. Petersburg Times and for their own good, here's how Ben described, I think it was Ben, in one of his stories, the abuse at the Florida School for Boys at Mariana. It left them, meaning residents, bloody, ruined their sleep, wrecked their marriages, and destroyed their lives. Goes on to point out that of 180 boys confined in the year 1988 alone, and there's an extraordinary story behind this, 174 were rearrested at one time or another during their adult lives. And it tracks investigations going back to 1903, when children were found shackled, and going forward through the decades. Similarly, Deadly Choices at Memorial begins, Sherry Fink's story begins with, you start reading it and you think it's a fairly simple question. She's focusing on a single doctor, Anna Pooh, who has been in the limelight. She's a doctor who was indicted for euthanizing patients and has since been active in advocating for certain legislative reforms. But the story becomes much more. It becomes a sort of investigative meditation on the behavior of medical professionals and public institutions under the greatest stress imaginable. And she says at one point, the distinction between murder and medical care often comes down to the intent of the person administering the drug. Now, both of these are very unusual. This is unusual terrain for journalism, the terrain of medical ethics 5 years past, the terrain of abuse of boys decades past. Let me start with a simple question. Why? Why do this work now? Why go over this terrain? Sherry, do you want to start?
Sure. Well, the story took a couple years, so it was earlier when I the why now would have been a few years earlier when I first got interested in looking at the story. But I think when I heard, like many of us did, that a doctor and two nurses who had sterling careers had been arrested and accused of second-degree murder, and I should say never indicted, yeah. I really just wondered what happened there. And having worked in a number of disaster and conflict situations and written a book called War Hospital about a war hospital in Bosnia that was where the medical staff was basically under siege for 3 years, I had had some exposure to the issues that can come up in medical centers that are under crisis situations. I'd never heard of anything quite like this before, and I just wanted to know what happened. Even if there wasn't mercy killing, what in the world had led other health professionals to allege that there had been? And because I had seen so many kind of analogous situations of medical professionals working in crisis situations, I had a sense that there would be some larger lessons at hand, and really had a sense that if this could happen at one American hospital, it could certainly happen at others, that so many parts of the country, any part of the country really, could be subject to a hazard of some natural or human-made disaster. And as I learned in researching this story, that our medical system is incredibly vulnerable to loss of power, loss of running water. So I really felt that there might be some larger issues to look at here.
And Elena, you're an editor at the Times magazine. You hear this pitch, you think, what?
Well, it's interesting because when I think one of the first versions of Sherry's story that we saw was an amazing TikTok of everything that had happened. And it was riveting, But it wasn't really what we typically do. We don't, at the magazine at least, we don't typically do investigative pieces about a time isolated from the present time. And I remember talking to Sherry about, you know, why? You know, how can we put this on the cover of the magazine, even if it's, it will make a great book, but why is this something that would be on the cover of the magazine? And Sherry always knew, even though it wasn't, I think, in the initial manuscript, she in her own head had connected these events of many years ago with implications and consequences for now. And so part of our job as editors was to figure out, okay, how do we frame this story, this very long story, in some larger context? And then we literally framed it. I mean, we literally started the piece sort of saying, these are the reasons why what you're going to read is important and contemporary, and we ended the piece sort of harking back to that.
And we'll talk a little more about the editing of it. And editing is kind of the back-end process that readers never see, but on a piece of the scope of either of these becomes very important. Ben, why?
I think I was just naturally curious about this place. This is probably the easiest sell of my career. You have a one-armed man, a creepy Southern Gothic town, and awful abuse inside of a place called the White House. We got turned onto this story by the Associated Press, and the St. Pete Times ran probably 20 inches of an AP story in the back of our metro section, and I stumbled onto it, as any reader would, and I thought, wow, there's something to this. Five men had found each other online. They had each gone online in search of information about the Florida School for Boys because of their experiences, and so one guy had started something of a blog, and he began to collect, collect their stories about their experiences at this place. And so they eventually convinced the state that it was time to fess up and to apologize for this, for these abuses. And the state held a little ceremony, kind of to, throw them in a bone, I think. And I thought when I read it, if there are those, if those five found each other randomly, there are a lot more. And sure enough, the floodgates opened. And we felt, to address your question why, we felt as Florida's largest and best newspaper, it was our obligation to answer the question, is this true? Did this really happen? And at the time, there were guards saying, no, it didn't, and there were a bunch of men saying, yes, it did.
But let me just push on the why a little bit more. This story defied a few standard journalistic rules. It was about stuff in the primarily distant past, in news terms, and it raked over terrain that actually a number of papers, including St. Petersburg Times at one time or another, had dealt with. So why bring it back?
Nobody had taken the long view. That was our mission from the beginning. I can't recall the first time I heard that I came across a report from an independent commission that the governor of Florida had dispatched in 1903. Go to Marianna, see how things are going at the reform school. And the report said, Governor, this is not a reform school. This is a prison for children. They found kids as young as six in shackles. We came across a dozen reports similar to that. And it seemed like every time there was an expose and every time this place had been scandalized, going all the way back to 1903, Floridians were outraged, no more. And then they focused their attention somewhere else, and things went right back to the way they had been before. It's very easy, I think, for people to hate juvenile offenders. They're the kids who key your car and spray paint on your garage door. And so it's they're not a political constituency. They don't vote. So it's very easy to forget about them and sort of think, well, they deserve what they get. So we wanted to, once and for all, spell this out and cover 100 years of history in this place. And also sort of, you know, point fingers at everyone, at the media, at the voters, at the politicians, because we're all responsible for this.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about photography, visual imagery, very important in the presentation of both of these. Ed, you ended up taking a lot of pictures.
Yeah.
For this. Talk a little bit about how you go about making pictures about stuff that happened a long time ago, about people nobody likes.
It was very difficult. I mean, you can't, as a news photographer, I'm usually photographing things happening in front of me, but this was probably the most difficult thing I've ever had to shoot. But one of the things that made it possible was the sheer scale of it. We had, close to 300 men come forward and claim they were abused, and I decided early on that I wanted to photograph as many of those men as I could. Just simple portraits, something to show you the scope of it. And then along the way, we found other things. Buildings that where they used to house the kids that were just decaying. And
I think one of those is on the screen there. And if you want to run through any other photos, feel free.
Yeah, this is about 24 pictures, some of my favorites. But this is the entrance to one of the cottages at the school. It is still open. This part of the campus just is not used. This is a man named Dick Colon who still has scars, 40 years later, from being beaten. This guy's named Aaron Burns. He's younger than most of the people. When we were in the building in the first slide, we found a list in a toilet with all the names of children at the school in 1988, and we contacted every single one of them, and he was one of those. He's been in and out of prison, I think, 4 times. But in all this, I mean, I wanted to show that these people had lived roughly, but I still wanted to give them some sort of dignity.
So the parents of a boy who died after being beaten at the school.
Ed, when you said you wanted to make simple portraits, talk a little bit about that decision. Why not something more dramatic? Why that sort of classical choice?
Well, I didn't.
Choice.
I wanted people to look at these men and see these men. I didn't want someone to say, "Oh, you know, look what the photographer did with, artificial light or fancy lensing." These men had wonderful stories, terrible stories, and I wanted people to see that and nothing else. This is interesting. It's a man named Stu Kruger who was at the school as a child. He went on to work on Wall Street. But when he was taken to the White House when he was in the school to be beaten, and someone went before him And as he was sitting in the hall, he picked up a pebble and started twirling it in his fingers while listening to this other kid screaming for his life. 50 years later, he can't go anywhere without a pebble in his pocket.
Sherry, your piece also benefited very much by the photography of Paolo Pellegrin, and he, I guess, accompanied you on some of your reporting. Again, on a story about stuff that happened a while ago, about the landscape of memory, how did you work with a photographer in this case?
Well, yeah, he was fantastic, and the photo editors really had gotten together and thought, they read the draft, and they thought really hard about the concept and which photographer would be right, and mm-hmm. they intentionally chose Paolo for his ability to work in situations of trauma. Yeah. And so, no, he didn't really accompany me okay. on my reporting, although he read the draft very carefully. We talked a lot about the different people, and then we went together to some of the places, but then he went alone to the people who he photographed, and he really got to know them separately from me and in his own way and appreciate things about them that and visually things that I, you know, had not. And that's the wonderful thing about the photography is that it, I think it adds real meaning to the story. And it was also wonderful because to that point, really, the only people who I had spoken with in depth about the people in the story and the story itself were the three editors who worked hardest on the story. And so it was kind of wonderful at that point to just really talk to someone else who was approaching that story and telling the story in his own way. And he went and visited them in their homes. And so that was really marvelous and I think contributed to, you know, my understanding. And so, yeah.
Elena, when the magazine is trying to figure out how to present this difficult story visually, and it is a difficult story. It's difficult because it's long, it's morally complex, it's packed with information. What was the conversation? How did?
Well, I remember one day one of the photo editors came to me with this incredibly elaborate spreadsheet with probably 20 characters because there were even more characters at some point. And the story wasn't finished, so I didn't really know. But based on what I had, I sensed who was going to feel central to the story. Mm-hmm. And we just literally went through in each person and made a list of which characters felt like, you know, X number of weeks from now when the story is finished, who will be the anchors. Mm-hmm. And I think Paolo does. He just has a great sense once he does meet someone, or in this case, some families, of how to get a picture to speak to a story.
Yeah. Ben and Sherry, let me ask you something else. When you go into a long story, a long reporting project, usually you have assumptions. You have some assumptions about the people you're reporting on, and you have assumptions of your own that you don't even know you had until you're kind of into it. Ben, you mentioned this actually about society's assumptions about some of the characters, the protagonists in your story. What, if any, assumptions did you trip over in the course of doing these pieces? What surprised you? Where did you go that you didn't expect, maybe?
Sherry goes first.
Yeah, no, I need a little time to think about this.
Go ahead. Try. All right, he leaned. He got it.
I thought it would be... difficult to get these men to speak about their experience. Many of them hadn't told a soul. It was their secret. And told their wives or their girlfriends or their children or the parents when they got out. And now they were, you know, 60, 70 years old and dealing with the manifestation of childhood trauma. So I thought it would take a lot of sort of coaxing, and I was completely wrong about that. They, you know, I could ask one question and listen to them for 2 hours, go through several cycles of crying and recovery. So that I think that was a kind of a wrong assumption.
Did you make a mistake at any point? Did you ask somebody something and realize, wrong thing?
You know, I knew it was going to be difficult from the beginning to present these men in a way that wouldn't turn people off automatically, because many of them had giant criminal histories. They'd been in and out of jail. They had beaten their children. They'd beaten their wives. And if you're trying to get a reader to hear the story of somebody who has committed those types of sins, there's a real challenge in that. So once in a while, I would, I'd be like, all right, tell me about your, you know, your criminal history, and you would hear things that, you know, just sort of, okay, he can't be my main character, you know what I mean? Yeah. So, I mean, there's some unforgivable sins, I think, and so that was a challenge.
Sherry, you had people telling you secrets. Do they?
I guess I sort of had the opposite experience, where I just went in and thought everybody would talk to me, and was maybe surprised at times when there was resistance to that.
What were the issues that people were most resistant about, or when? What's an example?
Well, I mean, the whole issue of hastening death is kind of a touchy one.
Did being a doctor make it any easier, the fact that you're a physician?
I guess, never having not been one, I'm not sure, but I think, yeah, I would assume that it probably did. And I guess that was the main thing. Maybe I went in thinking it would be easier than it was.
Could I just add, one thing that I was surprised about when I met Sherry is that she had already been, or once we had a draft, she had already been reporting for over a year, and I did assume that she would have certain assumptions, that she would be driven maybe by her sense that Anna Poe had clearly done something absolutely wrong, and that, you know, that she would be driven to sort of expose that. And I was really struck by the fact that I'm not sure what you felt deep inside, but I felt like you were completely open and just trying to absorb and observe what you had seen. And, you know, I didn't sense that you had assumptions about what had happened or what had motivated her. And that allowed you to report in a certain way and allowed, I think, the piece to, you know, as a reader, I think you're not told from the beginning how to feel about this. I think you're shown a lot of little steps, and you may have different ideas about it along the way. But I think that was very much helped by Sherry's not having a whole set of assumptions.
Was that, Sherry, a stance you sort of cultivated? Had you started with a kind of hotter sense of outrage, or was this really how you'd approached the whole thing?
It just really started with curiosity, and I really studiously wanted to not have assumptions. And I think it also helps maybe being a doctor, because you, in the patient interview, it's really important not to judge and just to be really open and let that person tell you their reality. And that's how I approached it.
Being medical doctors really helped Edmund and I with our story.
Edmund, I mean, as a photographer, you must have sometimes brought your own assumptions to bear, and did you make choices that had to do with countering that or embracing that? Or
I think I was kind of in the same boat as Ben. I was really surprised at how open these men were with us. There was a point, there was a photo that I showed you of a man's rear end, and asking a, you know, a 70-year-old man to take his pants off, I was expecting to get a, no way, no way, no way. He was like, sure. I mean, they wanted to share, and that really really dumbfounded me.
I'm going to ask a couple more questions, but I also want to have a conversation with you all and our panel. So think about questions you'd like to ask and maybe line up at the microphone so that everyone can hear you. I want to talk about editing. These are, and Elena, we'll start with you on these. These are huge, sprawly, both of these enormous pieces that begin with big stories and seem only to go out in more directions. What was the editorial process like for you as an editor once Sherry's story was in your hands? What did it take to make it usable, user-friendly?
Well, I think the first thing was to accept what the story was. As a magazine editor or as a New York Times magazine editor, we tend to see stories in certain ways and to frame stories in certain ways. And the obvious way to have framed the story, and in fact, before I even met Sherry, I had read about Anna Poe in a newspaper piece, and I thought, wow, you know, what an amazing story. It would be great to do a story about her, and maybe she would talk, and then you'd actually get, you know, fulfill the curiosity about what went on. And when Sherry first came to me, she was also framed the story in terms of Anna Poe. And after years of reporting and actually getting to talk to Anna Poe, she never really got what I think I had initially hoped, and I think she had initially hoped, which was to get inside Anna Poe's head, to understand the situation from her perspective, and to answer that question or even set up that series of questions about what goes on and how do we get from here? How do you get from being, you know, a beloved, esteemed doctor to a doctor who is, you know, accused of euthanizing patients? And once it became clear that we weren't ever going to get that story, then we had to think about, okay, well, what is this story if it's not that story?
And I was struck, in fact, on that point that, and I don't know whether this is an editorial decision or an author's decision, but regardless, the story deliberately draws the curtain at one point. I mean, you specifically say, we'll never know exactly what led Anna Poe.
I think that was probably. That, I mean, if my memory serves, you know, because we didn't have the answers to all the questions, I felt like one of the things that was important was that we let the reader know that we know that they have these questions. Yeah. We have these questions, and we just can't answer these questions. And once you're sort of upfront about that, then you're freer. You don't want a reader to think as you're reading, what's wrong with this story? What's wrong? You know, why aren't you answering these questions? So that probably had something to do with that, just acknowledging that there are things we would like to know, but we won't know. And then using all that Sherry did know, and Sherry did such an incredible amount of reporting and came at it in so many different ways from the perspective of different patients, from the perspective of the family members of the different patients, from the perspective of doctors who are much more open than Poe was. I mean, you know, one of the shocking things about the piece is that there are doctors who say, yes, we did do this. We thought that these people wouldn't survive, and so we decided to kill them. I mean, there are a couple of doctors who really say that. And so we just kept, or Sherry just kept building the story from all those different perspectives. And the hardest thing was, how do you have so many characters and not overwhelm a reader? How do you keep those characters straight? How do you decide when are there just too many? Mm-hmm. And that was just a balancing act.
What was that negotiation like from your point of view as the writer? Did you have to make huge, painful sacrifices?
Sure. Every writer feels that way. But, yeah, I think that we were thinking back, the original draft was about 18 or 19,000 words, and that felt concise to me.
And the final published length was?
13,000, which was the longest story we've ever published. So,
I think you had one longer. But it didn't, we should say, it never got to that length until the final proof. Like, it really was, like, still squeezing it down at the end. So, of course, but things can definitely get stronger as you cut. But there were some big sacrifices.
And, you know, I think you know, one way that Sherry and I dealt with this question, I mean, we knew we had a length we had to get to. So it wasn't like we were really fighting about that. We had a length. But then the question is, how do you think about cutting to that length? And as much as I knew about this story, Sherry knew 20 times as much about the story. And so there would be things in the story that I would want to cut because I didn't actually understand why they were significant. And I would, you know, maybe I would take it out, and then Sherry would put it back in, and I would say, wait a second, why is that back in? She'd say, oh, this is so important because, you know, this happens now, and then 3 days later that happens. And sometimes that was really important. And the only thing that Sherry hadn't done was realize that she knew so much that she hadn't actually made the connection for the reader between what happened here and what happened here. And so that just meant adding a few more words to make that connection.
Elena is a really wise and careful reader, and she would catch things like that. And if it wasn't working for you and if you weren't making that connection, no reader would too. And that was really, really important for the meaning of the story. And all three editors who worked on the story added in that way. Yeah.
So part of it was just deciding which of those things, you know, which of those connections were fantastic and let's add a few words, and which of those connections, you know, even when I understood, didn't really pay off, and so we would have to cut those.
How did these kinds of issues play out the St. Petersburg Times? I mean, all of you had a slightly different problem, not a single magazine piece, but a series that had to work within daily newspaper format, but you had hundreds of potential characters and decades of history and serendipitous reporting accidents falling upon this list of boys. What was the editing of this into, again, something user-friendly and something that fulfilled the mission?
It was a neat process. I mean, I learned tons. And Kelly Benham is, you know, one of the best editors in the business. And she took our first draft, Wave Nian, was maybe 12,000 words. Which is okay in the New York Times Magazine. It doesn't quite work in the St. Pete Times. And it was a process of fine-tuning and focusing and narrowing. And I think the first big story in the series ran at about 6,500 words. The process was incredibly collaborative from start to finish. I mean, once Wave Nian and I got teamed up and Edmund came on, we were having daily conversations about the directions we wanted to go to chase the story. And like I mentioned earlier, we got together when we had about 75% of the reporting done. We got together and basically mapped it on these giant pieces of paper and pasted them to the walls. Just to kind of see the story. You know, this was an investigation, but we wanted it to read like it was about 10 inches. And we never wanted you to hit a spot in the story where you felt like you were eating your vegetables.
I have to stop and just put a frame around both of those descriptions, those aspirations. Of wanting a story to read as if it was never more than 10 inches and is never want to feel as if you're eating your vegetables. That goes right into the hopper. Students will hear that for generations.
You're welcome.
Kelly, do you want to talk about this a little bit, about the editing of this monster? Use the mic up there. I mean, you're an enterprise editor, which means you're accustomed to thinking big, but this is really big.
Yeah, and we never knew when we started how big it was going to be or how one story would feed into another story would feed into another story, but we had a sense of the second and third and maybe fourth stories before we were finished with the first story. So one of the challenges was, when do we pull the trigger and how do we carve up these stories and you know, this is a story and that's a story and that's a story. The number of characters was overwhelming. Ben and Wave Nian and Edmund were consumed by all of these very similar tales and did an unbelievable amount of reporting. It's really hard when you've gathered all that stuff to gain altitude on the story and focus it and decide, well, this guy that I spent 5 hours with, he ain't going to make it. Yeah. He's not going to be in the story at all. And that was kind of my job, I think, when the 12,000-word draft came in. Ben is a phenomenally lyrical writer, and he's very easy to work with because he wants it to be better, and he wants collaborators. So working with Ben and Wave Nian and Edmund is the most fun I ever have on a story. But it was just a matter of saying, well, each character can only serve one function, and there can only be one character that you follow from beginning to end. So just having conversations with each other about how that's going to happen and how to write the how to tell the reader what a beating in that room felt like without having to hear it from 13 different men tell you the same story. So coming up with the concept of that composite scene where you hear the names again and again and again, but the reader knows they don't have to remember any of those names. I sort of took responsibility for that.
That's actually a really great description of the editor's role in a project like this, of taking responsibility for making certain things happen. Do any of you have questions or thoughts or queries on these remarkable stories? Josh.
Clean up on aisle 3. Hey. Well, it's just sitting right there. What can I do? I wanted to ask you a question about writing in the first person. That's something I've thought about a lot in my reporting. I'm adamant about not doing that at The Nation, even though my editors pushed me to, because The Nation is so connected with its, so known for its liberal op-ed pieces, and I don't want to be mistaken for one of them. Whereas at the same time, when I was here at Columbia, and my advisor wouldn't let me write my final investigation in the first person, I fired her and got a new one. So what made you decide to write in the first person, and how do you feel that kind of played out with your neutrality and that kind of stuff?
I don't know. Is there first person?
Is there any first person?
Could you read us a sentence?
Sure. Let's see here. Well, give me a moment.
Well, I mean, this beyond whether or not there's an actual, you know, first person singular in it, the question of how personal a voice you want to use in a piece like this is.
Yeah, no, you're right, because no, we did, like the he told me, we did that because we were trying to make clear how we got different bits of information.
Over the past 2.5 years, I have obtained previously unavailable records and interviewed dozens of people, and then...
It was all around the documentation and here, to make clear...
In the course of my reporting, I went to several events involving Poe.
Yeah. No, thanks for reminding. Yeah, because I'm not a first-person writer generally, and I kind of don't feel comfortable with it usually. I think there's some people who do it amazingly, and I've always found that much harder to do than other forms. But yeah, that was a conscious decision to make clear, because we wanted to be so careful about that the reader would know where each piece of information came from, that we did put that in to kind of clarify things like that and to give the reader more insight into the reporting process. But otherwise, I would have not use that. That was the purpose of that. Does that sound?
Yeah.
Thanks for reminding us.
This is for Ben and Ed. I my last job, I worked for a children's organization in Michigan that was closed down because of allegations of abuse of the young boys in their care. And what was interesting to me is that there were some people in the community who thought that abusing kids was not necessarily okay, but, and you know what I mean, the is it bloggers, is it the people who write all those opinions about stories?
The commenters.
Commenters. Yeah. There was a lot of sentiment that this is not a big deal. This is what you got to do to kids. And anyway, that organization reopened. It was nothing like you're describing, but yet, you know, it was enough to get them closed down. And so my question to you is what was, when you published this, what was the public's reaction, including those commenters?
I always picture them in boxer shorts and eating Cheetos.
For the record, we're making an audio recording of this.
There was, in Marianna, this is a small rural southern town, and I don't think you would have any trouble whatsoever finding people who live there who wish it were like it was in the old days when the parents could beat their kids, you know? Those places still exist, and there are a lot of them in Florida. that's part of, you know, what we wanted to do with this story, to leave no room for that side to make any arguments. If you think this is right, you're incorrect, and here's how you pay for that, you know? We did hear some of that. Vast majority of people were sorry that they had paid taxes to a state government that sanctioned this kind of abuse for so long.
And was there a response from Florida state government as the series unfolded?
There was. They've reduced the population at the school, which is still open, from 130 boys to about 70 boys. We think that they are getting close to shutting the facility. They fired the superintendent. The day after we left, an interview, they reviewed. We were telling them that you've got guards sleeping on the job. We're telling the administration. Yeah. So they reviewed the closed circuit video. God bless Florida for the sunshine laws, because we found this out afterwards, but just FOIAing. So they reviewed the closed circuit video and found six guards sleeping the day we were there on campus to talk to them. So they've taken some steps toward reform there, but we kind of decided that they don't get any more chances. you had your chances starting in 1903.
I've written a great deal, as I mentioned to you, about aging survivors. That is, you know, when survivors of trauma...
Yeah, could you use the microphone? Just pull it down so others can hear.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I forget I'm little. and that is what happens when you approach the normal phase of aging to people who had been traumatized earlier, not necessarily as children. And also about multi-generational legacies of trauma. That is what happens from generation to generation in the transmission of trauma when people are not cared for in the correct way. Can you elaborate? I'm sure you have also interviewed family members and maybe children. Mm-hmm. Have you seen, and by the way, when you do that from a lifelong point of view, you know that people who want to leave legacies want to speak. Even if they were silent for years and years, finally they want to tell the truth. So I'm not surprised about that. But can you tell a little more about what you find out in terms of the effect of the families they created and the next generation?
Yes. By and large, these guys were angry, quick-tempered, hit their wives, hit their children, except for those who didn't, who decided... I got that, and I don't like it, and I won't do it to anybody else. But I still hear from a gentleman named Jerry Cooper, who calls probably once or twice a week to retell me his story. And he gets emotional when he does it, just like he did the first time. It's as though he's in a cycle, you know? And I think for a lot of these guys, it was like that. Like, the recovery and the healing sort of starts now, 50 years later. It was delayed for all those years. I think you know, most of them probably suffer from PTSD and display symptoms similar to that, and their wives and families deal with, you know, deal with the effects. Waveney Ann wrote a story about the wives, and they were apologetic. They were also appreciative that they knew this now, because a lot of the men hadn't told their wives. So since this came out, it gave them permission to talk about their feelings. And I think for a lot of the wives, they were like,
relieved.
Oh, that's why he's like that. That's why I can't hug him, you know? And sometimes it was simply, that's why he has to sleep with the lights on.
Yeah, yes.
Good evening. I wish to thank all the panelists for coming this evening. I'd like to direct my questions to Mr. Montgomery and Mr. Fountain. I thought I heard Mr. Fountain say that they had visited the institution and that they found records in a toilet bowl.
That's correct.
Okay.
Why don't you tell the story, guys?
Yes, I would really appreciate it if you could unpack that story just a bit for me, please. Was this your first visit, your second visit? Were you alone?
It was the two of us.
Probably like third or fourth. There's a portion of the campus that's behind Razor Wire. That's a portion that's currently operating as a juvenile detention center. But there's another part of the campus that's been abandoned, and you saw the photo of the cottage overgrown with vines. So there were maybe a dozen other cottages like that.
We went into that building that
trespassing.
You saw.
These were buildings that appeared to be abandoned. Is that what you just said?
Yeah, they appeared to be abandoned, but they still had, you know, old beds in them. And
you just walked in. You thought you might have been trespassing, right?
The door was open.
I'm pretty sure they were trespassing.
We didn't really see it posted, but I there was a good chance we were trespassing.
And certain, you found papers in
but
a
we
toilet
were,
bowl?
As I was making pictures, and Ben was kind of exploring, and I came to him, you know, after maybe half an hour, and I was like, okay, you know, let's go. And as we're walking out, he's stuffing this old document, like, down the back of his jeans to hide it. And
it was 4 pages from April 21st, 1988. 180 names of boys who were there on that day. And we didn't know at the time what we're going to do with this, but it was one of those moments where, like, you know, the sun is shining, sort of shining through the cracks on the toilet, and it's, you know.
Did you ever find out how or why it ended up there?
I have no idea. No idea. And I mean, it was...
But it shouldn't have been there. I mean, those are supposed to be confidential. Yeah.
But there is a certain amount of serendipity that happens in these kinds of long stories, and it's not, I mean, you know, the list in the toilet bowl is fairly direct, but you probably had shared some moments of serendipity where the right person.
I'm actually just remembering this book I did on Bosnia, where the town that I wrote about, there had been a genocide there, Srebrenica, Bosnia, and the entire population of the town either fled or was killed, and then a new ethnic religious group kind of moved into the town, and they weren't really using the hospital. And I remember the first time that I trespassed around the hospital and found this trove of surgical records. And I had been interviewing the surgeons, and they had vague memories about when this happened or when that happened. And suddenly I had dates for everything. And I remember trading a bottle of Stuck whiskey for the head of the... I'm not proud of this, but the current head of the hospital, they weren't using that facility, but they were using a little clinic. And, you know, I couldn't just stuff it in my pocket because it was like troves of it, you know, huge lots. It was 3 years under siege. And so I had to kind of convince him to let me have it. And the first time we met, he said, "How would you like it if I killed you?" Because the U.S. had just bombed the Bosnian Serbs. Anyways, he liked whiskey. And then he was like, "Yeah, well, we don't need that." And it was just—it's so invaluable for the story, the book.
And I think that one of the things this underscores—that's actually very important—is that behind great trauma reporting is a love of craft, and love of craft that picks up on the serendipitous encounter with the document, and that also sustains you and actually enables us months later to joke about this stuff in the middle of interesting conversation about very difficult material. Edmund, I see you. Other questions and comments?
Can I get one more? I'm sorry.
But other folks should line up so that we can make sure to get all of you in.
I would just like to follow up with Mr. Montgomery and Mr. Fountain. I have often been told that success depends upon preparation. I think I heard Mr. Fountain say that he was surprised at how willing the men were to speak to him about details in their past that were very painful. So my question is, did you two have a strategy for establishing, did you have a strategy for showing empathy to get the men to trust you? Number two, did you stick to the strategy? Did it work? What did you learn from this about empathy? And what did you learn about collaboration and teamwork? Why do you think that you succeeded? Could you be frank and give a couple of examples? I know that's a multi-part question. I apologize.
I don't think we ever really sat down and said, okay, you know, this is how we're going to go about each one of these. But we were pretty open with the people, saying, you know, we're after the truth, and we want to get at the truth. Some people say, this is the truth. If it's not, then what is? And we just kind of sort of put the ball in their court to talk to us. And, you know, I think we were definitely empathetic, and I think I think in some cases we even got attached to some of these people. Some were genuinely likable guys, despite the fact that, you know, they used to run drugs from Bimini into Florida. But I think being honest, but at the same time being sensitive, really helped us. I think they saw that, that we did care about them, and we didn't see them necessarily as monsters, and that opened a lot of doors for us.
Thanks.
A question for Ben. I'm sure there must have been people who said, well, these guys went on to be criminals in their later lives because they were already criminals when we got them. I'm sure somebody must have, and what was the response to those kinds of statements?
You're saying people endorse the notion that these kids were born bad?
Yeah. That essentially.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure I heard some of that. I just refuse to believe that. I realize that, you know, a lot of people. I mean,
were there people that you interviewed on the subject, and what was their response?
We talked to a lot of professionals and people who deal with childhood trauma and the effects of the long-term effects of childhood trauma. And this is still like a fairly new field. I mean, there are some studies that exist, but still fairly new. How does trauma, you know, on a kid manifest itself when that child's an adult, and health reasons, and I mean health effects and psychological effects. So we got very familiar with that subject, and we talked to a ton of people, and we decided in the end that, you know, we really don't know. We know that there's a lot of evidence that suggests that if something bad happens to you when you're a kid, it's going to play out in this way and this way, but you can't really say. So what we did was just went the complete, like, transparent route. We're not here to prove to you that this event in their lives led them to this. We're not even sure that point A and point B are connected. What we do know is that the superintendent of the school in the 60s was saying, you know what, we're harming kids. And what we do know is that these men all shared this experience, and look at all the other things that are similar about their stories. Been in and out of prison for 50 years. They, you know, quick-tempered, blah, blah, blah. And we just kind of, I sort of viewed that, it's a section in the story, but I kind of viewed that like, you know, you put in the plug and you turn on the bath water and you just let it fill up until pretty soon water's pouring over the sides.
The second question was, you said that there have been stories done on this institution before, and there was a lot of alarm and viewing with alarm and all that kind of thing, and then they went back to doing what they were doing before. Mm-hmm. What do you think? I mean, if you went back and looked at it in 5 years, will it be different? Will it be substantially different, or
we decided that we will not turn away. I mean, if I have anything at all to do with this, I'm going to focus attention on this school until it's fixed or closed, and actually probably closed. That's a weird thing to say as a journalist, because you don't make decisions like that, but I heard from a former editor at the Times who wrote an email after one of our stories that said, it's good to see the Times crusading. And there's something about that that I like, crusading on the side of social justice and crusading for something that you know is right. And I don't mind that.
But journalists' lives take other courses. And in 5 years, you might be working in Texas or God knows where.
It would just be a harder sell the next place.
Thank you.
All right, so let's do two more questions here.
just recently from Texas. But Inman, your photos are stunning. And they're lyrical and beautiful. And
please make sure to speak into the mic so everyone can
hear. I was just waxing poetic about Edmund's photographs, and I wanted to ask you about the editing process. Working with a journalist, you wanted to do portraits on so many people, but with the editing process, maybe some of the most favorite portraits of the people didn't make it into
absolutely.
The story.
Absolutely.
And we saw a wraparound at the Dallas Morning News where there were so many images on the back page that was just wonderful. How did you deal? So I've got kind of two questions. How did you deal with, you know, following the story visually and having characters that didn't make the final narrative, yet you had these powerful images? And secondly, how do you, the voices in the stories that you guys have all heard, how do you detach if this is about the trauma? You've heard some horrific stories. How do you deal with that when you go home? How do you detach, if you ever do?
I guess first the editing, it was pretty heartbreaking to watch these pictures just kind of fall to the floor after I had invested so much time in creating them. But what Melanie's speaking of was kind of our way of showing, again, the scope of it, you know, this sea of faces. So we ended up using most every portrait that I had shot at that point, just to give an idea of scale. But as far as the dealing with the kind of the baggage of doing a story like this, I made a conscious effort when I started to talk about it with people. You know, I'm sure I drove some of my friends mad, but the stuff we were hearing was so dark that it was completely unhealthy to keep it, you know, in your head without somehow getting it out and trying to make sense of it. You know, Ben and I would talk quite a bit when we were driving back and forth from Mariana. Like, you know, how could this happen? You know, why would someone do this? And I think that helped quite a bit.
We also did a fair amount of drinking.
Sherry, how did you deal with the darkness of this story for you?
I think one of the great things was having this team of people to work with, and it was shared. That drama was shared around Elena, Susan, another editor on the story who, I can't remember if I said this in the interview we did before, but my desk and her office were really close to one another, and so any moment I could just kind of tell her what the latest thing was that I'd found out and really share that. And Krista Chelman, who did the web presentation, also sat nearby and was involved from like the very early time that I was at ProPublica. And then all three researchers who are here, David, Chuck, and Aaron, the head of the department, they got to know these people so, so well. And we really, I think in talking about the story, really processed a lot of those things. So I think, yeah, talking about it also was really, really helpful.
Great. Stephanie.
I also wanted to thank you all for coming here today and sharing your stories and the stories about the stories with us. One thing that strikes me about both this year's winners is that you deal with the ambiguity that is also part of the aftermath of trauma, which is that victims can be perpetrators and vice versa. As a journalist who has started to read up about trauma and all those issues, I have a question about character and storytelling, which is sometimes it seems so much easier if you could go in one way with the character and say, you know, this is really the bad person in the story. What both these stories or series have done well is, you know, trying to not go that route. Were there temptations? Were there moments when you sort of found yourself writing paragraphs that you said, well, no, I got to ditch that. That's really not what this story is about. Where you sort of had to remind yourself about that?
Taking out things that would be more pointing the finger at the...
Yes, where you feel that you, you know, you're really taking sides or that you sort of want to model the character for pure reasons of making the story better. In the storytelling sense, go in a certain way, as opposed to realizing this is really complicated and we got to deal with the complications.
Mm-hmm. I think we were, I'm trying to think of specific examples, but we were afforded the luxury of time and writing about, you know, writing gray into stories is encouraged. Mm-hmm. That's not the case at a lot of places, I think, but we're after the nuance. And, you know, you are, I think, tempted just when, you know, these guys had some serious baggage and they had done some bad things. And so I think, you know, sort of was the temptation not to turn readers off. Their childhood experience is incredibly important and we don't want to turn you off to who they became as an adult so that you can hear about this childhood experience. A little difficult navigating that, but I think I think we're after the sharp edges and yeah.
Talk about a little bit about how you characterize the one-armed man.
That's great. He was a monster from the beginning. This is a man named Troy Tidwell, who's still living, one of the only remaining disciplinarians from that era. And he was, the men spoke about him like this, like a monster. And we knew that wasn't totally true. He's a guy, he's lived in this community. And so he wouldn't talk to us, his attorney did, but, we were in constant pursuit of details that made him less of a monster, made him more nuanced character. And fortunately we were able to report in the end, this is a guy who, you know, sits in the second pew at the First Baptist Church on Sunday morning. And he's so self-conscious about his one arm that when he goes to dinner with family, he always sits with his arm to the wall. And he dances the foxtrot on Saturday nights. And he flirts with the ladies behind the perfume counter at the mall in Dothan, Alabama. All these things make him real. He doesn't exist just as a guy wielding a strap. He also exists in those other ways as well. And it's important.
Yeah, I guess, well, one thing that we had played with, or that I had written some drafts that kind of tied up the story more neatly at the end or gave some real firm lessons or kind of was more maybe didactic, and that was a real direction that I felt from the Times magazine was that we not go really in that route. And I think that could be one example where it's not really about a character, but just about trying to, you know, come out with some conclusion or some neat way of telling people what they should take from the story. And I'm not sure, in terms of characters, do you remember, or people in the story?
No, the only thing that I remember, and it's a slightly different thing, was there was a doctor who, Thiel, who really... toward the end of the story, told Sherry some things, including the fact that he suffocated someone with a towel, that we both wondered whether it would land him in jail. And I think we had a conversation just about, not that we weren't going to use that, but just about the implications of using that. and just thinking hard about all of that.
So we've spent the last hour really going on over really big terrain. We've been talking about storytelling and ethics and serendipity and alcohol and characters and pictures and all kinds of things. I wonder, as we wrap, if each of you, if anything's been jogged loose by this conversation for any of you that you'd like to throw out as a kind of bookend on the conversation, or anything you want to make sure gets part of this discussion. Edmund, do you have anything?
Well, I was thinking a little bit more about what Melanie asked me about things being cut, and we published stories on this for so long that ultimately I found a lot of pictures would have no meaning at first, and then 6 months later, suddenly we're writing about something where the photography makes sense, and most of the work that I did ended up being published. Which I thought was very unusual in a newspaper.
Sherry?
Yeah. Well, gosh, that just makes me think, I'm so grateful that the Times magazine, you know, made space for a long piece at the length that it did run, and that's a huge, a big thing in these days, especially the year that 2009 was for publishing. And I was thinking more about that question about, this maybe not that important, but about whether it's easier if you're a doctor to do stories like this. And I think in some respects it is, but it's also harder in one way, which is that sometimes if you're coming from another field into journalism, you're not taken as seriously as a journalist. And that can sometimes be an obstacle. And also just starting out as a freelancer, when people think about who they're going to tell their story to, they often want to tell it to someone who has a big media outlet behind them. And so that can be a challenge. But it can also be an advantage in various ways. So I think reporters need to take whatever their own situation is and just go with that and find the advantages in that.
I was also thinking, and Ben mentioned this earlier, you know, doing this kind of journalism is incredibly expensive, and it's incredibly important, but it's just very expensive. And whether it's his newspaper, his editor saying, yes, go do whatever you need to do, or in our case, having ProPublica, who was both able to fund Sherry and also help form the story, and then having our magazine say, okay, you five people are going to spend a really long time on this. It's investigative journalism is really important work, but it's incredibly expensive work, and you know, whatever way we as an industry can figure out to continue doing it seems really important.
Yeah, I just want to second that, and I'm sometimes forgetting the things that I said in the interview before we started here, but ProPublica, being hired by ProPublica, which is a newsroom specifically formed to invest in this kind of reporting, was hugely important aspect of being able to do the story and having those resources, both just, you know, the financial resources to be able to fly to New Orleans if something was happening, go see this person or that, and never being said no to in that way, but also the editorial resources and the web team and everybody, you know, that plus the incredible New York Times Magazine resources. I'm a very, very lucky reporter.
Ben, any want the last word?
I'm encouraged by this, and I think this, you know, this kind of journalism is pretty cool. write that down.
So many quotable quotes from this evening.
No, investigative storytelling, there's too little of it. You know, so often you get a lead and a nut graph and three bullets, and kind of this gotcha, you know, style. And I think there's, you know, there's room in, I think it will be useful for newspapers in the future to invest more in this type of work.
Well, thank you. The conversation can continue for a little while over whatever is left of the food and the wine and until the gods of the Journalism School evict us, but I want you to please join me in thanking our panelists, congratulating everyone again. And I hope we'll see you here next year. And again, my final ad of the evening, the Dart Center, www.dartcenter.org. Also for journalists here, we do have our Dart Center Ockberg Fellowships, a one-week seminar program. Applications now open. Details on the website. Thank you.